Principles of Economics textbook. Textbook available for free at cnx.org. Audio recording available for free at educateforfree.com. Summary, Chapter 29, 29.1, How the Foreign Exchange Market Works. In the foreign exchange market, people and firms exchange one currency to purchase another currency. The demand for dollars comes from those U.S. export firms seeking to convert their earnings in foreign currency back into U.S. dollars. Foreign tourists converting their earnings in a foreign currency back into U.S. dollars, and foreign investors seeking to make financial investments in the U.S. economy. On the supply side of the foreign exchange market for the trading of U.S. dollars are foreign firms that have sold imports in the U.S. economy and are seeking to convert their earnings back to their home currency. U.S. tourists abroad and U.S. investors seeking to make financial investments in foreign economies. When currency A can buy more of currency B, then currency A has strengthened or appreciated relative to B. When currency A can buy less of currency B, then currency A has weakened or depreciated relative to B. If currency A strengthens or appreciates relative to currency B, then currency B must necessarily weaken or depreciate with regard to currency A. A stronger currency benefits those who are buying with that currency and injures those who are selling. A weaker currency injures those, like importers, who are buying with that currency and benefits those who are selling with it, like exporters. 29.2. Demand and supply shifts in foreign exchange markets. In the extreme short run, ranging from a few minutes to a few weeks, exchange rates are influenced by speculators who are trying to invest in currencies that will grow stronger and to sell currencies that will grow weaker. Such speculation can create a self-fulfilling prophecy, at least for a time, where an expected appreciation leads to a stronger currency and vice versa. In the relatively short run, exchange rate markets are influenced by differences in rates of return. Countries with relatively high real rates of return, for example, high interest rates, will tend to experience stronger currencies as they attract money from abroad, while countries with relatively low rates of return will tend to experience weaker exchange rates as investors convert to other currencies. In the medium run of a few months or a few years, exchange rate markets are influenced by inflation rates. Countries with relatively high inflation will tend to experience less demand for their currency than countries with lower inflation, and thus currency depreciation. Over long periods of many years, exchange rates tend to adjust toward the purchasing power parity, or PPP rate, which is the exchange rate such that the prices of internationally tradable goods in different countries, when converted at the PPP exchange rate to a common currency, are similar in all economies. 29.3. Macroeconomic effects of exchange rates. A central bank will be concerned about the exchange rate for several reasons. Exchange rates will affect imports and exports, and thus affect aggregate demand in the economy. Fluctuations in exchange rates may cause difficulties for many firms, but especially banks. The exchange rate may accompany unsustainable flows of international financial capital. 29.4. Exchange rate policies. In a floating exchange rate policy, a country's exchange rate is determined in the foreign exchange market. In a soft peg exchange rate policy, a country's exchange rate is usually determined in the foreign exchange market, but the government sometimes intervenes to strengthen or weaken the exchange rate. In a hard peg exchange rate policy, the government chooses an exchange rate. A central bank can intervene in exchange markets in two ways. It can raise or lower interest rates to make the currency stronger or weaker. Or it can directly purchase or sell its currency in foreign exchange markets. All exchange rate policies face trade-offs. A hard peg exchange rate policy will reduce exchange rate fluctuation, but means that a country must focus its monetary policy on the exchange rate, not on fighting recession or controlling inflation. When a nation merges its currency with another nation, it gives up on nationally oriented monetary policy altogether. A soft peg exchange rate may create additional volatility as exchange rate markets try to anticipate when and how the government will intervene. A flexible exchange rate policy allows monetary policy to focus on inflation and unemployment and allows the exchange rate to change with inflation and rates of return, but also raises a risk that exchange rates may sometimes make large and abrupt movements. The spectrum of exchange rate policies include A, a floating exchange rate, B, a pegged exchange rate, soft or hard, and C, a merged currency. Monetary policy can focus on a variety of goals, A, inflation, B, inflation or unemployment, depending on which is the most dangerous obstacle, and C, a long-term rule-based policy designed to keep the money supply stable and predictable. Chapter 30, 30.1, Government Spending. Fiscal policy is the set of policies that relate to federal government spending, taxation, and borrowing. In recent decades, the level of federal government spending and taxes, expressed as a share of GDP, has not changed much, typically fluctuating between about 18 to 22% of GDP. However, the level of state spending and taxes as a share of GDP has risen from about 12 to 13% to about 20% of GDP over the last four decades. The four main areas of federal spending are national defense, Social Security, healthcare, and interest payments, which together account for about 70% of all federal spending. When a government spends more than it collects in taxes, it is said to have a budget deficit. When a government collects more taxes than it spends, it is said to have a budget surplus. If government spending and taxes are equal, it is said to have a balanced budget. The sum of all past deficits and surpluses make up the government debt. 30.2, Taxation. The two main federal taxes are individual income taxes and payroll taxes that provide funds for Social Security and Medicare. These taxes together account for more than 80% of federal revenues. Other federal taxes include the corporate income tax, excise taxes on alcohol, gasoline, and tobacco, and the estate and gift tax. A progressive tax is one, like the federal income tax, where those with higher incomes pay a higher share of taxes out of their income than those with lower incomes. A proportional tax is one, like the payroll tax for Medicare, where everyone pays the same share of taxes regardless of income level. A regressive tax is one, like the payroll tax above a certain threshold, that supports Social Security, where those with high income pay a lower share of income in taxes than those with lower incomes. 30.3, Federal Deficits and the National Debt. For most of the 20th century, the U.S. government took on debt during wartime and then paid down that debt slowly in peacetime. However, it took on quite substantial debts in peacetime in the 1980s and early 1990s before a brief period of budget surpluses from 1998 to 2001. Followed by a return to annual budget deficits since 2002, with very large deficits in the recession of 2008 and 2009. A budget deficit or budget surplus is measured annually. Total government debt or national debt is the sum of budget deficits and budget surpluses over time. 30.4, using fiscal policy to fight recession, unemployment, and inflation. Expansionary fiscal policy increases the level of aggregate demand, either through increases in government spending or through reductions in taxes. Expansionary fiscal policy is most appropriate when an economy is in recession and producing below its potential GDP. Contractionary fiscal policy decreases the level of aggregate demand, either through cuts in government spending or increases in taxes. Contractionary fiscal policy is most appropriate when an economy is producing above its potential GDP. 30.5, Automatic Stabilizers. Fiscal policy is conducted both through discretionary fiscal policy, which occurs when the government enacts taxation or spending changes in response to economic events, or through automatic stabilizers, which are taxing and spending mechanisms that, by their design, shift in response to economic events without any further legislation. The standardized employment budget is the calculation of what the budget deficit or budget surplus would have been in a given year if the economy had been producing at its potential GDP in that year. Many economists and politicians criticize the use of fiscal policy for a variety of reasons, including concerns over time lags, the impact on interest rates, and the inherently political nature of fiscal policy. 30.6, practical problems with discretionary fiscal policy. Because fiscal policy affects the quantity of money that the government borrows in financial capital markets, it not only affects aggregate demand, it can also affect interest rates. If an expansionary fiscal policy also causes higher interest rates, then firms and households are discouraged from borrowing and spending, reducing aggregate demand in a situation called crowding out. Given the uncertainties of interest rate effects, time lags, including implementation lag, legislative lag, and recognition lag, temporary and permanent policies, and unpredictable political behavior, many economists and knowledgeable policymakers have concluded that discretionary fiscal policy is a blunt instrument and better used only in extreme situations. 30.7, the question of a balanced budget. Balanced budget amendments are a popular political idea, but the economic spirits behind each proposal are questionable. Most economists accept that fiscal policy needs to be flexible enough to accommodate unforeseen expenditures, such as wars or recessions. While persistent large budget deficits can indeed be a problem, a balanced budget amendment prevents even small, temporary deficits that might, in some cases, be necessary. Chapter 31, 31.1, How Government Borrowing Affects Investment and the Trade Balance. The change in any part of the national saving and investment identity suggests that if the government budget deficit changes, then either private savings, private investment in physical capital, or the trade balance, or some combination of the three, must change as well. 31.2, Fiscal Policy, Investment, and Economic Growth. Economic growth comes from a combination of investment in physical capital, human capital, and technology. Government borrowing can crowd out private sector investment in physical capital, but fiscal policy can also increase investment in publicly owned physical capital, human capital, such as education, and research and development. Possible methods for improving education and society's investment in human capital include spending more money on teachers and other educational resources, and reorganizing the education system to provide greater incentives for success. Methods for increasing research and development spending to generate new technology include direct government spending on R&D and tax incentives for businesses to conduct additional R&D. 31.3, How Government Borrowing Affects Private Saving. The theory of Ricardian equivalence holds that changes in government borrowing or saving will be offset by changes in private saving. Thus, higher budget deficits will be offset by greater private saving, while larger budget surpluses will be offset by greater private borrowing. If the theory holds true, then changes in government borrowing or saving would have no effect on private investment in physical capital or on the trade balance. However, empirical evidence suggests that the theory holds true only partially. 31.4, Fiscal Policy and the Trade Balance. The government need not balance its budget every year. However, a sustained pattern of large budget deficits over time risks causing several negative macroeconomic outcomes. A shift to the right in aggregate demand that causes an inflationary increase in the price level, crowding out private investment in physical capital in a way that slows down economic growth, and creating a dependence on inflows of international portfolio investment, which can sometimes turn into outflows of foreign financial investment that can be injurious to a macro economy. Chapter 32, 32.1, The Diversity of Countries and Economies Across the World. Macroeconomic policy goals for most countries strive toward low levels of unemployment and inflation, as well as stable trade balances. Countries are analyzed based on their GDP per person and ranked as low, middle, and high-income countries. Low-income countries are those earning less than $1,025 or less than 1% of global income. They currently have 18.5% of the world population. Middle-income countries are those with per capita income of $1,025 to $12,475 a year, or 31.1% of global income. They have 69.5% of world population. High-income countries are those with per capita income greater than $12,475, or 68.3% of global income. They have 12% of the world's population. Regional comparisons tend to be inaccurate because even countries within those regions tend to differ from each other. 32.2. Improving countries' standards of living. The fundamentals of growth are the same in every country. Improvements in human capital, physical capital, and technology interacting in a market-oriented economy. Countries that are high income tend to focus on developing and using new technology. Countries that are middle income focus on increasing human capital and becoming more connected to technology and global markets. They have charted unconventional paths by relying more on state-led support rather than relying solely on markets. Low-income, economically challenged countries have many health and human development needs, but they are also challenged by the lack of investment and foreign aid to develop infrastructure like roads. There are some bright spots when it comes to financial development and mobile communications, which suggests the low-income countries can become technological leaders in their own right, but it is too early to claim victory. These countries must do more to connect to the rest of the global economy and find the technologies that work best for them. 32.3. Causes of unemployment around the world. Cyclical unemployment can be addressed by expansionary fiscal and monetary policy. The natural rate of unemployment can be harder to deal with because it involves thinking carefully about the trade-offs involved in laws that affect employment and hiring. Unemployment is understood differently in high-income countries compared to low- and middle-income countries. People in these countries are not unemployed in the sense that term is used in the United States and Europe, but neither are they employed in a regular wage-paying job. While some may have regular wage-paying jobs, others are part of the barter economy. 32.4. Causes of inflation in various countries and regions. Most high-income countries have learned that their central banks can control inflation in the medium and the long term. In addition, they have learned that inflation has no long-term benefits, but potentially substantial long-term costs if it distracts businesses from focusing on real productivity gains. However, smaller economies around the world may face more volatile inflation because their smaller economies can be unsettled by international movements of capital and goods. 32.5. Balance of trade concerns. There are many legitimate concerns over possible negative consequences of free trade. Perhaps the single strongest response to these concerns is that there are good ways to address them without restricting trade and thus losing its benefit. There are two major issues involving trade imbalances. One is what will happen with the large U.S. trade deficits and whether they will come down gradually or with a rush. The other is whether smaller countries around the world should take some steps to limit flows of international capital in the hope that they will not be quite so susceptible to economic whiplash from international financial capital flowing in and out of their economies. Chapter 33, 33.1, Absolute and Comparative Advantage. A country has an absolute advantage in those products in which it has productivity edge over other countries. It takes fewer resources to produce a product. A country has a comparative advantage when a good can be produced at a lower cost in terms of other goods. Countries that specialize based on comparative advantage gain from trade. 33.2. What happens when a country has an absolute advantage in all goods? Even when a country has high levels of productivity in all goods, it can still benefit from trade. Gains from trade come about as a result of comparative advantage. By specializing in a good that it gives up the least to produce, a country can produce more and offer that additional output for sale. If other countries specialize in the area of their comparative advantage as well, and trade, the highly productive country is able to benefit from a lower opportunity cost of production in other countries. 33.3. Intra-industry trade between similar economies. A large share of global trade happens between high-income economies that are quite similar in having well-educated workers and advanced technology. These countries practice intra-industry trade, in which they import and export the same products at the same time, like cars, machinery, and computers. In the case of intra-industry trade between economies with similar income levels, the gains from trade come from specialized learning in very particular tasks and from economies of scale. Splitting up the value chain means that several stages of producing a good take place in different countries around the world. 33.4. The benefits of reducing barriers to international trade. Tariffs are placed on imported goods as a way of protecting sensitive industries for humanitarian reasons and for protection against dumping. Traditionally, tariffs were used as a political tool to protect certain vested economic, social, and cultural interests. The WTO has been and continues to be a way for nations to meet and negotiate through barriers to trade. The gains of international trade are very large, especially for smaller countries, but are beneficial to all. Chapter 34, 34.1, Protectionism, an indirect subsidy from consumers to producers. There are three tools for restricting the flow of trade: tariffs, import quotas, and non-tariff barriers. When a country places limitations on imports from abroad, regardless of whether it uses tariffs, quotas, or non-tariff barriers, it is said to be practicing protectionism. Protectionism will raise the price of the protected good in the domestic market, which causes domestic consumers to pay more, but domestic producers to earn more. 34.2. International trade and its effects on jobs, wages, and working conditions. As international trade increases, it contributes to a shift in jobs away from industries where that economy does not have a comparative advantage and towards industries where it does have a comparative advantage. The degree to which trade affects labor markets has a lot to do with the structure of the labor market in that country and the adjustment process in other industries. Global trade should raise the average level of wages by increasing productivity. However, this increase in average wages may include both gains to workers in certain jobs and industries and losses to others. In thinking about labor practices in low-income countries, it is useful to draw a line between what is unpleasant to think about and what is morally objectionable. For example, low wages and long working hours in poor countries are unpleasant to think about, but for people in low-income parts of the world, it may well be the best option open to them. Practices like child labor and forced labor are morally objectionable, and many countries refuse to import products made using these practices. 34.3. Arguments in support of restricting imports. There are a number of arguments that support restricting imports. These arguments are based around industry and competition, environmental concerns, and issues of safety and security. The infant industry argument for protectionism is that small domestic industries need to be temporarily nurtured and protected from foreign competition for a time so that they can grow into strong competitors. In some cases, notable in East Asia, this approach has worked. Often, however, the infant industries never grow up. On the other hand, arguments against dumping, which is setting prices below the cost of production to drive competitors out of the market, often simply seem to be a convenient excuse for imposing protectionism. Low-income countries typically have lower environmental standards than high-income countries because they are more worried about immediate basics such as food, education, and healthcare. However, except for a small number of extreme cases, shutting off trade seems unlikely to be an effective method of pursuing a cleaner environment. Finally, there are arguments involving safety and security. Under the rules of the WTO, countries are allowed to set whatever standards for product safety they wish, but the standards must be the same for domestic products as for imported products, and there must be a scientific basis for the standard. The national interest argument for protectionism holds that it is unwise to import certain key products because if the nation becomes dependent on key imported supplies, it could be vulnerable to a cutoff. However, it is often wiser to stockpile resources and to use foreign supplies when available, rather than preemptively restricting foreign supplies so as not to become dependent on them. 34.4. How trade policy is enacted, globally, regionally, and nationally. Trade policy is determined at many different levels: administrative agencies within government, laws passed by a legislature, regional negotiations between a small group of nations, sometimes just two, and global negotiations through the World Trade Organization. During the second half of the 20th century, trade barriers have, in general, declined quite substantially in the United States economy and in the global economy. One reason why countries sign international trade agreements to commit themselves to free trade is to give themselves protection against their own special interests. When an industry lobbies for protection from foreign producers, politicians can point out that because of the trade treaty, their hands are tied. 34.5. The trade-offs of trade policy. International trade certainly has income distribution effects. This is hardly surprising. All domestic or international competitive market forces are disruptive. They cause companies and industries to rise and fall. Government has a role to play in cushioning workers against the disruptions of the market. However, just as it would be unwise in the long term to clamp down on new technology and other causes of disruption in domestic markets, it would be unwise to clamp down on foreign trade. In both cases, the disruption brings with it economic benefits.